I'm excited about the paperback version of Darwin's Doubt because the publishers allowed me to write a chapter responding to the main critics of the book. And I think this is exciting because it's really going to advance the debate.
So says Stephen Meyer, the author of the explosive New York Times bestseller Darwin's Doubt, which is now being released in an expanded paperback version. In Darwin's Doubt, Meyer lays out the amazing scientific evidence for intelligent design at the dawn of animal life. And he reveals the debates going on among top scientists about Darwin's theory, debates that the mainstream media ignore. Darwin's Doubt has just been released in paperback with a brand new chapter. Get Darwin's Doubt today at darwinsdoubt.com. That's darwinsdoubt.com.
Does information in living organisms that is carried outside of the DNA pose a challenge to Darwinian evolution? We're going to discuss this question today on the ID the Future podcast with Jonathan Wells, a senior fellow of the Center for Science and Culture, who's just published a fascinating article in Biocomplexity, a peer-reviewed open-access scientific journal that's the leading forum for testing the scientific merits of the claim that intelligent design is a credible explanation for life. I'm Casey Luskin, research coordinator for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and today on the ID the Future podcast, we're going to discuss Dr. Wells' new article titled Membrane Patterns Carry Ontogenetic Information That Is Specified Independently of DNA. This is the last in a series of four interviews with Dr. Wells discussing his new article. Again, as we've discussed in previous podcasts, we all know that DNA carries biological information. But as Dr. Wells has explained, the DNA information in an embryo can only do its job in the context of spatial information that is specified independently of the DNA, and some of that spatial information is carried by the cell membrane. We've also discussed the fact that some of that information is carried in the membrane in the form of a sugar code and also in a bioelectric code. In today's interview, we're going to discuss what all this means for embryo development and evolution. So, Dr. Wells, thanks so much for continuing this discussion with us on ID the Future.
Happy to be here, Casey.
So, Dr. Wells, in some of our previous podcasts, I think you've very convincingly shown that embryo development requires information carried by membrane patterns in embryonic cells. Isn't it possible, however, that those patterns are specified by a genetic program in DNA?
No, for two reasons. First, DNA sequences do not completely specify proteins, or RNAs for that matter. The membrane patterns we were talking about depend on localized sugar molecules, glycoproteins, glycolipids, or ion channels in the membrane, and specifically those three-dimensional patterns formed by those molecules. So even the protein molecules that make up the patterns are not completely specified by DNA, as I'll explain more in a minute. Second of all, even if DNA sequences completely specified proteins, the three-dimensional pattern in the membrane would not be specified by DNA. So those are the two reasons why you can't reduce the information to DNA.
Okay, so this is interesting stuff. I know that it's going to maybe challenge the paradigms that many of our listeners might have been taught when they were learning biology in high school, but this is where biology is going today in the year 2014. So could you explain to us, why does DNA not completely specify RNAs and proteins?
Sure. First of all, the usual sequence is DNA makes RNA, RNA makes protein. The first step is called transcription from DNA to RNA. The second step is translation from RNA to protein. But if we look at those steps, let's take the first one, DNA to RNA. After DNA is transcribed into RNA, many RNAs, perhaps most, at least in animal cells, are spliced. That is, they're cut apart and put back together again, and they can be put back together again in several different ways. In fact, we know of one sequence of DNA in fruit flies that can basically make over 18,000 different RNAs. So this is alternative splicing. So in the first step, the DNA does not completely specify the RNA. The second thing that happens to RNA is it can be edited. So apart from the splicing, the actual subunits in the RNA can be changed by the cell. In the next step, from RNA to protein, the translation step, RNAs do not completely specify the final form of many proteins. First of all, some proteins with the same or very similar amino acid sequences can adopt different final folded forms. These are called metamorphic proteins. many proteins don't form a final folded form at all until they interact with other molecules in the cell. These are called intrinsically disordered proteins. So the basic point is that from DNA to RNA to protein, you're adding information along the way and ending up with far more proteins than you can trace back to that DNA sequence. Finally, most proteins are, as I said in an earlier podcast, glycosylated. That is, complicated sugar molecules are added to them, which have important biological consequences. So that, again, makes it impossible to trace that back to the DNA sequence.
So, of course, you're not saying that DNA doesn't make RNA or RNA doesn't make protein. Of course, DNA does make RNA and RNA does make protein, but there's a lot more information that's coming into this process beyond just those very simple basic steps that many of us learned in high school biology. And that information is not necessarily coming directly from the DNA.
Exactly. So makes, yes, in a very loose sense, but not in the sense of specifies. So you need DNA to make the RNA. You need the RNA to make the protein. But in fact, you need a lot more.
That makes sense. So it's a follow-up question. You say that even if DNA completely specified RNAs and proteins, that would not specify the spatial arrangements of the proteins in the membranes. Why is that?
Well, most proteins, of course, they're released from the nucleus, and then they have to go to the right place in the cell. So they have target areas that they go to. But like a zip code in a postal system, many proteins have a sequence attached to them that helps guide them to the right place. But if you think about the postal metaphor, the zip code doesn't specify the place. It just tells you which place you're supposed to go to. But the place has to already be there. So the location to which the protein is headed has to be there before the protein is synthesized. And those locations, specifically the patterns in the cell membrane, don't come from the DNA. In many cases, they come from membranes that preceded them. So when a cell divides, it imparts its membrane pattern to the daughter cell, and it acquires its pattern that way rather than through the DNA. And this has been shown in many different types of cells, mostly single-celled organisms, but also in multicellular organisms.
So are all the cell membranes in an embryo specified by membranes that preceded them then?
No, that would be all too simple, wouldn't it? But unfortunately, as the embryo develops, the membrane patterns of its cells have to change because the membrane pattern of a muscle cell is very different from that of a nerve cell or a skin cell or a heart cell. New membrane patterns have to arise in the course of embryo development. They don't just come from preceding membranes. And yet, the DNA isn't producing the original pattern, much less the subsequent patterns.
So you say that membrane patterns are not specified by the DNA. Are they random then? What are they?
Well, they're certainly not random. Embryo development is really amazing in the sense that it always goes to the right place if it goes at all. A fertilized frog egg will always give you a frog. A fertilized fruit fly egg will always give you a fruit fly, unless, of course, it's stopped along the way. This development is blocked. You can end up with a deformed fruit fly or a deformed frog or a dead fruit fly, but you don't get anything from a fruit fly egg except the fruit fly. So development is very robust, very reliable. Actually, embryos can recover from amazing damage. Embryologists see that every day. But the outcome is always somehow predetermined in the sense that the species identity is always there.
So why is that the case? What is producing this kind of fidelity in embryo development?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know completely. We have a lot to learn, which for me is exciting because if I thought that science had already uncovered everything we need to know, it would be a very boring activity. So we're still learning what it is that leads to these new membrane patterns. But I find one promising area, one promising approach, is called relational biology. This was developed half a century ago by two guys, Nicholas Reshevsky and Robert Rosen. Now, most biologists think in what I would say are Newtonian terms, that is, matter in motion. So molecules are like the atoms in Newton's universe, and their places in the embryo are like the position and so on. And the forces between the molecules are the forces in the Newtonian universe. And so the idea is you can build up complex patterns in an embryo just by explaining the interactions between these individual molecules. But in fact, that doesn't work. I can give you every molecule that's present in a living cell, and you can't make a cell out of it. because what's essential is the organization. And molecular biology, unfortunately, discards the organization to study the individual molecules. And once it does that, you can't get the organization back. Relational biology emphasizes the organization and makes it the primary fact rather than the molecules that make up the organization.
Could you maybe elaborate some more on what relational biology is?
Yes. Well, it's at this point largely in the theoretical stage, unfortunately. It's been largely neglected because of the emphasis on Darwinian evolution, which we'll come to in a minute. But it is being developed, actually, quite extensively. Rosen developed it. Other people, Aloysius Louis has developed it. A friend and colleague of mine, Richard Sternberg, is applying relational biology right now to specific features of living systems. And fortunately, there's a well-worked-out mathematical framework for it. It's called category theory, which was developed originally back in the 1940s, and again has been used to work out in great detail at least the theoretical aspects of relational biology. So it's a research program at this point, but I think it's a very promising one.
So, okay, we've talked about the different sources of information that are involved in embryo development. What does all of this mean for evolutionary theory?
Well, of course, there are many different evolutionary theories, but the dominant one nowadays, as we all know, is called the modern synthesis, or as some people call it, neo-Darwinism. And this is Darwin's theory that all living things are modified descendants of a few common ancestors, and the agent of modification has largely been natural selection. And then you add to that modern genetics, and especially molecular genetics, DNA and RNA, and you get the modern synthesis, in which new features arise through changes in DNA sequences. And this is the point where the evidence for information outside the DNA poses a very serious, I would say fatal, challenge to neo-Darwinism. Because you can change the DNA all you want, and you haven't really changed the information that's there before it and that helps to guide its expression.
Well, thank you, Dr. Wells. This has been a very enlightening conversation, not just about the sources of information that are beyond the DNA in living organisms, but also the evidence for that information and what that means for development and evolution. So thank you, Dr. Wells, for your time.
Very welcome.
Again, we've been discussing a new article by Dr. Jonathan Wells titled "Membrane Patterns Carry Ontogenetic Information That Is Specified Independently of DNA." You can download the paper free in the open access peer-reviewed journal Biocomplexity. The website is www.bio-complexity.org. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.